Ladies and gentlemen, today I shall speak about structural and non-structural in music in a very special sense. As an introduction to the specific sense in which I shall employ these notions, let us consider the first example in the handouts. I hope everyone has the handouts, the examples. Example 1A shows Schumann's the opening of Schumann's Vogel als Prophet. Examples 1B through 1D are reproduced from Oldworth and Schachter's classic textbook on harmony and voice leading, in which this Schumann passage serves as an introductory example of figuration. Each example is a reduction of the previous one, leaving out layers of figuration. Hence, if we remove the chromatic appoggiaturas and quick arpeggiations, we get example 1B. The low G can be perceived as a stationary bass, since register connections shown by lines in example 1A suggest that the chord change at the end of measure 1 stands for inner voice motions. Example 1C reduces off octave shifts and shows only the basic voice leading between the tonic triad and a neighboring 6-4 chord. Ultimately, however, even this 6-4 stands for embellishment within the tonic triad, which is all that is left in example 1D. It is in this sense illustrated by this example that I shall speak of structural and non-structural elements today. The structural basis of the passage is given by the tonic triad with the fifth in its soprano. If we go backwards from example 1D to 1A, we can see and hear how the music is generated step by step by adding relatively non-structural layers of figuration or embellishment. Example 1E shows another way to indicate structural hierarchy, employing graphic notation developed by Heinrich Schenker. In this notation, note values do not indicate durations but relative structural weights, where slurs and beams denote structural connections. The note heads without stems stand for surface elements with the least structural weight. Eighth notes and flagged half notes indicate neighboring tones, which embellish the structurally superordinate elements shown by quarter and half notes. The half note G and D have primary significance for the structure as the two structural outer voices. Once again. As this example illustrates, non-structural by no means equals to less important. The particular charm and expression of the Schumann passage is obviously lost by removing the non-structural elements. As Odell and Schachter put it, elements of figuration are part of the essential substance of music. Though they are, in a sense, ornamental, they are by no means merely a decorative overlay. It would make as much sense to think of leaves and flowers as mere decorations on a tree. Aside from this organicist tree metaphor, we might also compare structural relationships in music with those in a related human activity, namely syntactic relationships in language. The elements on which syntax relies are by no means always the same that carry the most significant expressive content. For grasping how a tree or a sentence is organized, however, it's necessary to make a distinction between the leaves and the flowers and the branches and the trunk, or between the subject and the predicate and the subordinate constituents. Similarly, the distinction between the structural and the non-structural is crucial for comprehending the Schumann passage. The emphatic C-sharps become pungently expressive precisely because they do not belong to the structural background harmony, but form dissonances against it. And the fact that the passage can be meaningfully reduced to a G minor triad has crucial consequences for its relationships with wider contexts, both within this particular composition and with respect to the entire enormously influential cultural phenomenon of conventional tonality. The questions whether and how we can distinguish between the structural and the non-structural in the sense just demonstrated pose problems that are central for music theory and analysis. For surface figures of conventional tonality, such a distinction is usually more or less uncontroversial, as in the Schumann passage. Today, however, I shall focus on two more disputed areas, which can be understood as concerning generalizations of those relationships that are most familiar to us from tonal surfaces. The first issue concerns post-tonal music. If the music does not observe the organizational principles of conventional triadic tonality, can we distinguish the structure from the non-structure in a way analogous to tonal figuration? The second issue concerns large-scale organization in tonal music. Can we extend the kind of structural hierarchy that the Schumann example illustrated for a short span to ever larger scales, so that entire pieces can ultimately be understood as figuration within the tonic triad? The basic postulate in Heinrich Schenker's theory of tonal organization is that such an extension is possible. However, while Schenkerian analysis has become a widely practiced method in the study of tonal music, the nature of Schenkerian structures, whether they actually describe an aspect of compositional syntax or whether they just reflect Schenker's a priori assumptions, has not been illuminated to the extent that one would hope for. For approaching both issues, let us first try to get a better picture of the criteria of analysis according to which musical elements' structural positions are to be identified. In the Schumann example, one criterion is obviously based on the pre-existing norms of consonance and dissonance. The opening C-sharp is dissonant against the G-minor triad formed by the remaining tones. The neighboring 6-4 that appears in example 1b is also dissonant. Significantly, the criterion of consonance and dissonance is not readily applicable to post-tonal analysis or to large-scale tonal analysis, the two issues of our interest today. In post-tonal music, we cannot rely on pre-established norms of consonance and dissonance, even though the analysis may sometimes suggest that some harmonies are contextually established as taking structural precedence in the manner of functional consonances. In tonal analysis, larger structural hierarchies cannot be determined on the basis of consonance and dissonance either, since they involve relationships between several chords that are locally consonant, even though Schenkerian theory posits that only some of the chords prevail at deeper structural levels, whereas others support elements of figuration within these deeper level harmonies. Our little Schumann example is not, however, based on consonance and dissonance alone, but also illustrates analytical criteria that can be generalized to our more problematic issues. As particularly significant criteria, we should identify those based on design, register, and metric and rhythmic emphasis. The compositional design identifies the passage in example 1a as a unit, since it is followed by somewhat different treatment of the material. Structural elements, such as the tonic in this case, usually appear at the framing points of units of design. As for register, we have already identified G as the structural base owing to its low register position relative to the remaining elements. In general, location in relative register extremes tends to support structural significance. The status of D as the structural top voice is supported by its high position as the goal of the opening register ascent. Further analytical criteria are given by metric and rhythmic emphasis. A basic principle of figuration is that metric strength tends to correlate with structural weight. For the opening C-sharp, this principle is of course overridden by its dissonance. However, the rhythmic emphasis on the C-sharp does pertain to the structure. While it cannot elevate the dissonant C-sharp itself to structural significance, it enhances the focus on its resolution, corroborating the status of D as the structural top voice. All in all, design, register, meter, and rhythm provide us criteria that we can assume to be relevant for structural analysis even when consonance and dissonance are not available to us as criteria. During the rest of this lecture, I shall be examining the consequences of this assumption in selected analytical examples. Before entering analysis, one further structural principle needs to be identified. In tonal music, non-harmonic tones connect with harmonic tones by melodic steps, whereas larger intervals form chordal skips or arpeggiations. In the Schumann, the C-sharp of course resolves to D by a half step, whereas the following leaps arpeggiate the G-minor triad. The neighboring 6-4 also connects with the tonic triad through stepwise motion. While in post-tonal music we cannot define steps and leaps on the basis of the diatonic scale, I shall apply a related principle to to post-tonal analysis, calling it the proximity principle. Under proximity principle, half-step and whole-step motions connect by default non-harmonic and harmonic tones, whereas larger intervals form arpeggiations. It's worth noting that the proximity principle is closely related with a well-established phenomenon of auditory perception concerning the significance of pitch distance for the formation of so-called auditory streams. However, for reasons of time, we cannot penetrate more deeply into this perceptual issue. Now, please turn to example two for considering a simple post-tonal example. Béla Bartók's Microcosmos piece from the island of Bali opens as shown in example 2A. Example 2B shows some readily apparent features of its pitch organization. Each hand employs a symmetrical set of four notes, the right hand set being a transposition of the left hand set at the minor third. So left hand set, the right hand set. The impression of overall registral symmetry is enhanced by the imitation by inversion. With just a few exceptions, the entire pitch material in this piece is based on just these two sets. Together, the sets compose the octatonic scale, in which the octave is divided by regular pattern of alternating half and whole steps. Both the sets of each hand and the overall octatonic scale are widely employed resources in the 20th century modernist music. What interests us today is, however, whether and how these notes can be divided into structural and non-structural. Example 2C reproduces Edward Laufer's quasi-Schenkerian graphic analysis published in the proceedings of a conference on music theory in Tallinn 2003. Laufer's notation indicates that he takes the initial E-flat as structurally subordinate to the following D as its neighbor. Similarly, G-sharp is shown as subordinate to E, B to C, and G-flat to F. The notes of greater structural weight form what Laufer calls prime sonority, which we can identify as the D minor seventh chord in second inversion. Laufer's analysis suggests thus that the music is based on the figuration of this chord, comparable to the way in which the Schumann passage was based on the figuration of the G minor triad. Laufer's reading of neighboring relationships clearly conforms with the proximity principle, but his determination of the structural hierarchy raises questions. How do we know that the opening E flat is subordinate to D and not vice versa? Laufer offers no explanation to this question. In the Schumann, we hear the opening C sharp as subordinate to D owing to its dissonance, but a similar argument cannot be applied to the Bartók. And if we consider the analytical criteria I identified, design, register, and metric and rhythmic emphasis, none of them turns out to support Laufer's reading. The first melodic figure employs E-flat as a metrically strong framing pitch, which is also the local registral apex and further emphasized as the sustained note in measure 2. The right-hand imitation of this figure affords analogous emphasis on B. Moreover, the left-hand G-sharp and the right-hand G-flat are supported by the extreme registral positions in the overall setting and also by secondary metric accents. In measures 5 to 7, in which the right-hand material is raised an octave higher, these registral extremes also receive the main metric and rhythmic emphasis. All this suggests a structural hierarchy that is exactly opposite to Laufer's reading, as indicated in the alternative reading of example 2D. Hence, measures 5 to 7 elaborate a framework of fifths notated as diminished sixths rather than the fourths of Laufer's reading, and the underlying harmony appears as a root position G sharp minor seventh chord rather than the inverted D minor seventh. The significance of rhythmic emphasis for the organization of this music becomes all the more evident by comparing the opening events to the closing section. Now please turn to example 2e. Here, above the pedal D, the notes of the D minor 7th are emphasized by meter and duration, whereas the notes of the G sharp minor 7th occur as short, unaccented notes, which can be readily perceived as neighbors. Hence, while both the opening and the closing sections employ similar four note sets in each hand, there's a shift of emphasis within these sets, moving from the notes of the G sharp minor 7th to those of the D minor 7th. Whereas Laufer's reading fails to reflect this crucial large-scale idea, example 2F models it in terms of an underlying large-scale progression. In the opening section, we have the G-sharp 7th as the structural harmony. Then, after intervening events shown in parentheses, which we have to skip for reasons of time, we arrive at the D minor 7th. The G-sharp minor 7th is identified as a kind of a large-scale appoggiatura chord to the D minor 7th, whose position as a goal is underlined, among other features, by the low pedal. Of course, one might still question whether the best way to model this shift of emphasis is in terms of underlying harmonies. However, in measures 40 and 41, Bartók himself answers these questions, as it were, by stating these harmonies explicitly as block chords, as a kind of cadenza gesture, so as to confirm their harmonic significance. To use Schenkerian vocabulary, the background progression is lifted to the foreground so as to summarize the large-scale progression. If the cadential chords provide a summary of the large-scale progression, some previous details can be heard as foreshadowing it. As shown in example 2F, the D minor 7th already becomes temporarily prevalent at the end of the opening section, measure 11. And in fact, one might also hear the very opening surface figures as already manifesting a striving towards the D minor 7th. I try to articulate as if striving there. Here it should be recalled that being non-structural does not mean being insignificant. Aspects of significance that non-structural elements often assume include anticipating upcoming structural elements and reminding of previous ones. Now, I should acknowledge that while preparing this lecture, it occurred to me that since the shift of emphasis from the G-sharp to D minor 7th is so clearly manifest in the music, I'm not likely to be the first to observe it. And indeed, by browsing the literature, I found an article by Richard Korn from 1991 in which he provided an essentially similar description of this shift and its connection with the cadenzal chords. While my observation thus unfortunately turned out to be unoriginal, I nonetheless wanted to discuss this example today since it gives such lucid illustration of my topic's criteria and implications of analysis. Moreover, there are significant observations to be made that go beyond Korn's analysis. One crucial observation concerns the privileged position of root position minor 7th. This is an aspect ignored by Korn, whose approach was based on pitch class sets, which is a concept that ignores the registral distribution of pitches. While this is a fairly standard approach to post-tonal harmony in the United States, it often fails to account for compositionally and perceptually significant aspects of harmonic organization. In the present case, it seems highly significant that both the opening G-sharp minor 7th and the closing D minor 7th are in root position. In fact, while our analysis has not started from any a priori assumption about consonance and dissonance, it suggests a posteriori that a root position minor 7th chords assume the role of functional consonances in the context of this piece. The pedal D can thus be explained as necessary for bringing the goal harmony into the privileged root position, whereas both Korn's and Laufer's analysis make the pedal appear as a more or less arbitrary move. As shown in example 2G, Laufer shows the pedal as a transferred inner voice, which is a reading that completely fails to account for the obvious prominence of this element. Another noteworthy feature in the relationships between the pedal and the upper voices is indicated in example 2F within the square brackets. Except for its top voice F, the closing D minor 7th approximates close harmonics or overtones of the pedal. This suggests that the privileged status of D as the harmonic root also involves a psychoacoustical aspect, since it completes the intervallic pattern in a way that resembles those patterns that are fundamental to our pitch perception. This is an explanation that draws on the psychoacoustical theory of harmonic roots that was originally presented by Ernst Erhardt. So far, I have tried to demonstrate how our structural approach, based on criteria such as meter, rhythm, design and register, and on the proximity principle, helps us to understand the internal organization of this piece. In addition, this analysis helps to reveal connections between this composition and Bartók's music at large, offering a glimpse of its rich cultural dimensions. The minor seventh chord is a generally significant harmony for Bartók, often assuming a role that can be identified in terms of functional consonance. In fact, in his Harvard lectures, Bartók himself pointed out the consonant nature of this chord in connection with his harmonizations of folk songs that use the Hungarian pentatonic mode, shown in example 2H. D, F, G, A, C. The chord can be derived from the mode by removing one of its tones, which is conceivable as a passing tone. In his Bagatelle opus 6, number 4, Bartók lucidly demonstrates how the minor seventh is elevated to the rank of functional consonants by harmonizing a folk song phrase, first by triads and then by seventh chords. The melody and harmony show close coordination. If we remove two unaccented passing tones, the melody can be conceived of as horizontalization of the minor seventh chord. In From the Island of Bali, Bartók ostensibly seems to mediate sounds from a distant and exotic island, but lets his Hungarian heritage to be heard as the structural background. The geography of the title should perhaps not be taken too seriously, though. There's, to my knowledge, no gamelan music based on the octatonic scale, even though Janos Karpati has suggested a connection between the four-note sets and the Indonesian melog scale. But if it's questionable whether this piece actually represents an encounter of Asian and European influences, it certainly points to other aspects of synthesis that are highly pertinent to Bartók's art. It connects symmetric intervallic constructions that are typical of 20th century Western modernism with a framework with ancient Hungarian peasant roots. Moreover, it relates the principle of registral symmetry with a blatantly asymmetrical function of the pedal, which also relates with the asymmetry of the harmonic series. What remains to be discussed is the very last gesture of this piece. Please look at example 2I. The two cadential chords are followed by two extreme register staccato notes, which somewhat provokingly fail to conform with our structural model. These notes cannot be readily explained as figuration within the D minor seventh, even though Edvard Laufer does attempt such an explanation by reading them as implying a resolution to omitted F and A. So according to Laufer. I find this reading far-fetched and unintuitive and poorly substantiated by both this piece and Bartók's more general practices. In order to be true to the music, we should not try to make this gesture fit into the previous structural model, but rather recognize the limits of its explanatory scope. The staccato gesture marks the exit from the island of Bali by not conforming to otherwise prevalent structural relationships. To my ears, the staccato notes do not suggest a resolution to the D minor seventh, but rather hint at an enlargement of this chord. Such a notion is supported by the larger context of Bartók's sound world, in which the enlarged harmony would be quite at home. For example, we encounter a similar harmony as forming the framework for the beginning of the second movement of Bartók's Concerto for Orchestra. Let us now turn to another postural example, Debussy's Piano Prelude, Boal, whose opening section is shown in example 3a. We might begin by noting two points of contact with the Bartók example. First, the musical surface is pervasively based on a scale that derives from the regular division of the octave. Now it is the whole tone scale instead of the octatonic. Second, this music also features a low pedal point. The B-flat appears in measure 5 and remains in the music for most of its duration. While time doesn't allow a comprehensive analysis of this prelude today, I will try to demonstrate that our analytical criteria again help us to illuminate both the internal relationships within this composition and its external relationships with larger cultural contexts. The opening section introduces two melodic subjects labeled here as parallel third subject and primary melody, the latter of which is the most significant thematic idea in this prelude. The lower system of example 3a shows a structural interpretation of these two subjects, indicating that each subject is based on a harmonic framework consisting of G sharp or A flat, C and E, an augmented triad. Such a notion is a new one. An essentially similar analysis was already presented by Adele Katz in 1945. For the parallel third subject, the reading is rather unproblematic. The augmented triad is formed by the rhythmically emphasized points, except for the F sharp B flat in measure 2, which is interpreted as a neighboring element by virtue of the proximity principle. The structure of the primary melody is, however, less self-evident. Note that its first three notes, A flat, B flat, C, first appear in isolation, denoted as pre-echo. This helps to identify this progression as a unit. However, when the melody arrives at emphatic D in measure 10, which is highlighted by the reappearance of the parallel third subject, this may at least momentarily create the impression of D as a structural goal. Nonetheless, the structural priority of the F-flat C-E triad is vindicated by the subsequent EDC figure, which, as shown by brackets, relates parallelistically with the initial A flat B flat C figure. As shown by dotted ties, the structural position of C and E is also supported by the register connections with the endpoint of the parallel third subject. C-E triad materializes above the pedal B-flat as a combination of the two subjects' endpoints. Just like in the Bartók example, our analytical approach, in which melodic motions are interpreted in terms of an underlying harmony, is rewarded and confirmed by the subsequent appearance of the harmony as an explicit verticality. Further block chord occurrences of this triad appear in the harmonized version of the primary melody's opening figure, measure 15. prominent D was identified as a non-structural neighboring tone with the primary melody, we should once again recall that non-structural does not mean unimportant. Moreover, as our Bartók example illustrated, elements that first appear in non-structural circumstances can hold structural potential that is later realized. In Voile, a crucial structural feature undetected in Adele-Katsi's analysis is the elevation of D to structural significance. The opening E-flat, B-flat, C figure of the primary melody is repeated in its harmonized form in measures 15, 17, and 19. And these occurrences are followed at the end of the first section by pianissimo D octaves in a way that echoes the original introduction of D, so from measure 15. Original D was sandwiched between the proximate C and E, these octaves lift D to the highest register where it stands unchallenged by proximate tones. Moreover, if you turn to the next example in your handouts, example 3B, you will be able to see that from this point onwards, D is constantly present as a prominent textural element in ostinato and other figures in various registers. In vain of Orwell and Schachter's organicist tree metaphor, we might say that the primary melody is a flower that contains the prominent D as a seed from which the subsequent development grows out. Or in terms of the linguistic metaphor, the primary melody is a sentence in which D is introduced as a subordinate constituent whose crucial expressive significance compels taking it up as the main constituent in the ensuing discourse. Now I shall play the music from measure 21 to 33. I hope you can follow the score excerpts and analytical graph in example 3D, focusing on the adventures of D. By violent quasi-glissando gestures whose apex D-flat finally provides registral continuation to the gentle D octaves that close the opening section. So, followed by... Register design and proximity suggest thus that our structural approach provides the key for understanding how the pentatonic episode relates with the rest of the music. While time doesn't permit a thorough discussion of structural functions, the D appears here as an element of tension, a rival of the original A-flat C-E triad, whose increasing claims for supremacy can only be extinguished by the half-step motion to D-flat, which leads outside the original whole tone set and triggers a dramatic outburst of the pentatonic section. Example 3C summarizes the most significant large-scale features. Now please turn to example 3D, which illustrates a crucial aspect in the relationship of the pedal B-flat with the upper voice element. As in the Bartók, the choice of the pedal can be explained on the basis of its harmonic series, into which the main upper voice elements, the opening A-flat C framework and the arrival D neatly fit. While the registered positions of these elements greatly vary in the course of the music, it's worth noting that in the first confrontation, the registered setting is close to that of the harmonic series. While the harmonic series is pertinent to harmony in both the Debussy and Bartók examples, this does not yet point to a specific cultural connection between the two, but rather reflects the more general influence of a psychoacoustical phenomenon on the evolution of Western harmony. If we're searching for more specific historical roots of the Buhl harmony, they can be found, I would suggest, from dominant conglomerations and enharmonically related augmented sixth chords, such as shown in example 3e. The Buhl chord can be formed by combining a dominant ninth with a flat fifth, which is enharmonically related with the so-called French sixth chord. In romantic music, dominant ninths were functional dissonant, but sometimes, as in the Schumann song in example 3f, they became prominent expressive elements with an expressive effect suggesting tranquility or peacefulness rather than tension or discordance. In the music of Debussy and his contemporaries, we can outline a process in which such chords were gradually emancipated from the need to resolve to triads until they were given the role of independent structural frameworks. Buhl represents music at the endpoint of this process. Example 3f shows some glimpses of the preceding stages. The Scriabin passage seems to be just on the verge of exiting tonality. Its opening is pervasively based on transpositions of the Buhl chord, and the eventual triadic resolution sounds surprising, almost as being out of place. As we know, Scriabin was soon to dispense with such tonal resolutions in his later output. Debussy's contemporary. The introductory section of the slow movement of Sibelius's Fourth Symphony. Whether this music is tonal or post-tonal may not be immediately apparent from the musical surface, but I will show how this question can be clarified through the present analytical approach. For a taste of the non-tonal tendencies in this music, let us first listen to measures 5 and 6. In isolation, this whole tone flavored passage does not reveal any clear tonal basis. However, design register and rhythmic emphasis suggest that the structural tones within this passage are first F, B and F, then E flat and A. As indicated in the analytical graph, these tones can be interpreted as forming the French sixth chord. However, on the subsequent B flat minor chord suggests that the French sixth is not in this case quite emancipated from the tonal norms of consonance and dissonance, since it can be heard as providing a resolution of the augmented sixth. For seeing how this detail relates with a larger context, we must consider the introductory section as a whole. As indicated by the brackets above the score, its design shows a partition into three units, the first and the last of which show a similar internal design. Each unit starts from a triad and ends with a dissonance that can be interpreted as an augmented sixth, resolving to the root of the subsequent triad. The first unit starts from the A minor 6-4. Here. We hear here A and G, or A and F double sharp, which can be heard as resolving to the subsequent G sharp minor. In the third unit, we get similarly from the B flat minor, measure 7. This chord, which resolves analogously to the horn's A major passage. Which is the first anticipation of the main thematic idea in this movement. On the larger scale, the framing harmonies of the entire introductory section are the opening A minor 6-4, the harmony in measure 8. Which combine to form a chromatically transformed version of the conventional resolution of the cadenzal 6-4. Hence, the opening bass E ultimately functions as a dominant that leads to the A major tonic of the horn passage. The Schenkerian graphs in example 4b illustrate step by step how the introductory section can be derived from a conventional structural background. Graph 2 shows the tonal progression, and graph 3 its chromatic variant. For reasons of time, I will not go through the remaining graphs, but by comparing them to the score, it can be easily verified how their indicated structural positions are supported by the design of the music, as well as several register features. While it would be desirable to dwell a bit longer on this complex Sibelius passage, these observations already suffice for making some significant conclusions. While this music locally seems to verge on atonality, it is still designed in a way that reveals a logical connection with an underlying tonal framework. While Sibelius stretched tonality to its limits, he did not quite break those limits, which of course bears crucially on our understanding of this important symphonic movement and also on Sibelius's position in his historical context. While the criteria behind my Schenkerian analysis of the Sibelius passage are clear indeed, the validity and implications of such criteria are by no means self-evident for Schenkerian analysts at large. Edward Laufer has presented an entirely different reading of the very same passage. As shown in brackets beneath the score in example 4a still, Laufer identifies the tonic of C-sharp minor as being structurally present already in measures 5 and 15. I find little or nothing in the music to support such a notion. As indicated by example 4c, my reduction of the entire movement, the tonic of C-sharp minor is attained only after the introductory section, measure 20. For those not acquainted with Schenkerian analysis, it should be noted that the caretted numbers above the open note heads, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, denotes degrees of the Urlinie. In Schenker's theory, the Urlinie is an archetypal top voice progression that descends from one of the tonic chord pitches, in this case the fifth, to the tonic note. While we have no time for discussing the justification of this reading, now I shall return to the concept of Urlinie in its concrete manifestations in my final example. But we shall not yet go there. Please. While the introductory section of the Sibelius movement does not establish C-sharp minor structurally, this doesn't mean that certain features do not already foreshadow the upcoming tonal center. Hence, once again, an initially non-structural element can be identified as a seed of the structural. As shown in example 4d, the C-sharp minor figure at the end of the introduction initiates a chain of motivic associations that eventually leads to the crystallization of the main thematic idea on a securely established C-sharp minor tonic. Now, I would like to emphasize that in twice citing Edward Laufer's analysis as negative examples, I by no means wish to launch a personal attack at him. Laufer is one of the most accomplished Schenkerian analysts. For this very reason, however, his failures in the present examples point to a major defect in the current stage of Schenkerian studies. While Schenker already developed a highly advanced theory of structural relationships, no equally well-established or consistent theory of analytical criteria has emerged. Hence, even the best analysts, such as Laufer, sometimes present readings that seem to show a lack of awareness of the implications of the actual musical features, such as those identified today as analytical criteria. My final example, example 5, will concern the implications of such criteria for music that is unambiguously tonal. Example 5 takes us almost 200 years backwards in time, showing excerpts from Bach's invention in G major in alignment with my Schenkerian graph of the entire piece. The brackets above the score show the partition of the invention into three sections and their subdivision into smaller units of design. I shall next play the invention in its entirety. At places in which the score is not given, I hope you will be able to follow the Schenkerian reduction. This task will be facilitated by the regularity in which the voice leading agrees with the meter notated by bar lines. Once again, the analytical criteria that lead to my structural reading are not difficult to understand. The primary harmonies occur at the framing points of units of design and are also strong in terms of the hypermeter indicated by the numbers between staves. The second section begins with a four-measure unit of imitational design, which leads from the cadentially established dominant in measure 14 to the fourth degree in measure 18. Then a two-measure sequence leads to the second degree in measure 20. The second degree is marked with a trill, a prominent textural element that binds together a large unit of six measures. The trill starts from the right-hand C and appears then in measure 24 in the left hand, again highlighting C and concretizing the transference of the Urine 4 from the top voice to the bass as shown by the arrow. Harmonically, the passage just heard is governed by the second degree, whose outer voices are subjected to a voice exchange as shown by the crossing lines. A noteworthy feature within this passage, marked with a large asterisk, is the apparent tonic in measure 22. Reading this chord as non-structural is supported not only by design and hypermeter, but also by the relatively high register of its bass. Similar criteria support the non-structural status of the other asterisked G major chord in measure 17. My analysis asserts thus that there's a deeper structural level at which the second degree remains in force from measure 20 to 25. Where the top voice B in measure 22 is locally consonant, it functions as a passing tone within the underlying second degree. In measures 25 and 26, the second degree leads to the dominant 4-2, which makes the C or Urline 4 dissonant, compelling it to resolve to B in the bass. This B, measure 27, initiates the third section, which cites the invention theme at its original level, marking the structural return of the tonic. The B, or Urline 3, is transferred to the highest voice through another voice exchange, which also brings the tonic chord into root's position. The attainment of this 3 is highlighted by its register location, one octave higher than the other Urline tones. The remaining measures transfer the 3 back to the basic register and close the structure by 2 and 1, accompanied by the customary authentic cadence. As before, our analytical criteria have significant implications for understanding both the internal relationships within this composition and its external relationships with practices of wider cultural significance. The design of this invention supports one of Schenker's Urline archetypes so as to suggest that such an archetype was relevant to Bach's composition. What is especially noteworthy is the treatment of the 4 and the 3, which are crucial for the Urline descent where the progression starts from the 5th, as in the present case. The 4 and its prolongation are marked by the trill as an outstanding textural element, and the 4-3 relationship is further clarified and emphasized by the reciprocal voice exchanges. Despite the clarity of the criteria that lead to this reading, we should again note that these criteria are not self-evident to all practitioners of Schenkerian analysis. Under our criteria, the asterisked G major chords in measures 17 and 22 cannot function as structural, but the structural tonic only returns at the beginning of the third section. However, there exists a textbook on Schenkerian analysis that doesn't even consider this possibility, but identifies the two asterisk chords as the only alternatives for the structural tonic return. Through design, meter, and register, Bach seems to have done his best to secure that these chords are not heard as decisive for structure, but the authors of this textbook apparently based their analysis on some other criteria, perhaps just taking any arbitrary occurrence of the tonic triad as structurally significant. If Schenkerian analysis is practiced or taught on such a basis, it can be rightly questioned whether it has any value in illuminating a musical organization, as it fails to reflect the composer's treatment of chords and adds nothing essential to ordinary chord-by-chord analysis. And most significantly, such analysis fails to reveal the strength and lucidity in which the Schenkerian archetype is manifest in the actual compositional features of this invention. The Urline archetype is, of course, one of the aspects that suggests significant relationships between this invention and wider musical practices. According to Schenker, the Urline pertains as an organizational principle to the repertoire of German masterworks from Bach to Brahms, and as suggested by my Sibelius graph, this pertinence may even extend somewhat further. For a more focused glimpse on comparative perspectives, we might take a look at example 6, a very short look, which exposes Schenkerian reductions of 6 inventions, or 5 words, with a similar formal design. In each case, a short recapitulation section is approached through a 5-4-3 top voice progression, and in this respect, the structure of the G major invention is based on a recurring underlying pattern. A closer look at this example would also reveal interesting differences, but we have no time to consider them now. Our last example 7, points to another aspect of comparative perspectives, concerning the voice leading pattern of the trill passage in the G major invention. Example 7a shows this pattern in the abstract. A strong 2 chord is followed by a weak apparent tonic and a strong 2-6, suggesting that the second degree prevails at the deeper structural level and is prolonged through voice exchange. This too is a recurring pattern as exemplified by the remaining Bach excerpts, in the latter of which the second degree is in the dominant key and functions as the pivot of modulation. If Schenkerian analysis seeks to reveal structural levels that underlie composition, we might expect that an awareness of such patterns is a prerequisite for analysis. However, the authors of the textbook just cited are not the only ones failing to show such awareness. As shown by asterisks, other analysts have also taken the weak tonic chords within this pattern as structural without giving any special justification. Concerning the choral passage at the bottom, there was a dispute in the literature whether dominant is structurally established at the end of measure 4 or at the end of measure 6. None of those who participated in this dispute, however, showed awareness of a third possibility, since design and hypermeters support the second degree of E major in measures 5 to 7, this suggests that the dominant is only established through the concluding cadence. At the beginning of this lecture, I posed the questions whether and how the kind of structural principles that are most familiar to us from tonal surface figuration can be generalized to post-tonal music on the one hand and to large-scale tonal organization on the other. The analysis discussed suggest that such generalizations are indeed possible and fruitful for illuminating both the internal relationships of these works and their external relationships with wider cultural phenomena. The significance of such generalizations for composition is not perhaps so surprising if we take into consideration that principles of figuration are fundamentally significant for music cognition. It seems reasonable to assume that composers who have internalized these principles from tonal surface organization may more or less instinctively resort to similar principles for organizing post-tonal music or larger spans of tonal music. It is, of course, difficult to tell with certainty whether or not composers have been consciously aware of the structural relationships that are revealed by analysis. For the most cases, no documents point to such awareness, although it seems possible that Bartók, who explicitly pointed out the significance of the minor seventh chord for his music, may have based the structure from the island of Bali on a conscious plan. Generally speaking, this issue is illuminated by the comparison between the present musical structures and syntactic structures in linguistic communications. The origins and function of such structures do not rely on conscious planning, but rather they manifest the quest for coherent expression, a striving fundamental to humanity. It should be added, however, that while generalizations of figurations are certainly significant resources for musical organization, we should be cautious not to assume that they are always pertinent to all music. There certainly exists a wide variety of other resources and other structural principles. My primary aim today has thus been to demonstrate that the present structural approach has a large potential to illuminate questions relevant to various branches of music research, including history and cognition. As a secondary aim, I have tried to give an idea of the reasons why the analytical community has not quite succeeded in reaching this potential. The main reason is the lack of a consistent, well-established analytical criteria. In the present examples, I have tried to show clearly how the identified structures are supported by features such as design, register, and metric and rhythmic emphasis. Given the fundamental significance of these features for music perception, it can be readily understood why composers resort to such features for a clear expression of underlying structural patterns. However, I have also shown that such features are by no means always consistently taken into account in Schenkerian or quasi-Schenkerian analysis. As a result, the picture about the empirical support that there is for such analysis as describing compositionally pertinent structures has not been clarified to the extent that one would hope for. Indeed, Several Schenker critics have questioned such compositional pertinence, suggesting that Schenkerian analysis only reflects the underlying theoretical assumptions. Through the present examples, I hope to have given an idea how Schenkerian analysis and related post-tonal analysis can be brought closer to the ideal of empirical research of compositional patterns, even though it should be admitted that the questions about analytical criteria are often more complex than in the present examples, which I have largely been chosen on purpose for their clarity. In any case, approaching this ideal would be necessary if we aim for a fuller realization of the potential that the illustrated structural approach has in illuminating questions of music research.